Welcome to Recalculating America, a program dedicated to small business in America. Recalculating will help you, the American small business owner, build a new business or help you to grow your existing one. Each week, experts will give you useful information about starting your new business, and you will hear from professionals selected to help you grow your business. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest and has many years of experience helping small businesses build and grow their businesses. Now he is sharing his ideas with you over the air. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money. He specializes in helping small business owners make their money work as hard as they do. Now, your host, Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins.
Good evening, Dan Perkins here, and I'm your co-host along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating, a program dedicated to helping small business leaders increase their profits. We draw our name from the best-selling book by the same name, which features the contributions of more than 100 presidents, experts, and leaders, all of whom offer ways to grow your small business. Don, why don't you tell us about our first guest?
Well, as you know from your charity, Soldiers and Sailors, getting a good night's rest is an important way to reach good health. And today we have what I think is a very interesting and unusual guest, Danielle Galley. She's founder of NOLA Sleep, and it is, according to some people, revolutionizing the mattress industry. Danielle, welcome to the show.
Thank you, thank you, and thank you for having me on.
Yeah, good morning, or good evening, I should say. Before we get started talking about your technology, could you perhaps tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this business of selling mattresses?
Sure, I'd love to do that. I'm actually been doing mattresses and bedding products for almost 12 years now. So before I started to do mattresses, I was actually doing comforters and pillows for people that were suffering from allergies. And that's actually my original bedding products. And when we saw that these pillows and comforters that we were doing for people that were suffering from allergies, that they were actually working and helping people sleep better, we decided to also make the mattress itself so that we could give people the opportunity to both have a great mattress and also pillows and comforters, because that's kind of makes up the whole bed. So I have a background in bedding products and sleep material science. So the original invention that we did many years ago were actually a filling material for these pillows and comforters that we did, an allergy-friendly, natural filling material. So that's my background. I've been doing this here with a great deal of passion since I was very young, since I was 25, started my first pillow company. It's a bit unusual that you're 25 and you start a pillow company. But that was what I just ended up doing because I saw that there was a need for people like myself suffering from allergy, getting some better materials in bed, if you could say that, to help relieve some of these allergies. So I saw a need. I had allergies myself, and I just went for it, and it was success almost instantly. And since then, I've been doing bedding products all over the world. So we sell a lot of our pillows and comforters to big box retailers all over the world. And then we do the NOLA mattress over here in the U.S., which is only for the American market. So unfortunately, which is obviously a good thing, the NOLA mattress is only available for people here in the States. And it is a bit of a revolution because it's using a new type of material that you cannot find in any other mattress. So that was kind of a bit of a background story for me myself.
That's great. The name of your company is NOLA, and can you tell our listeners your web address?
Yes. The web address is NOLA Mattress, and NOLA is actually a name. So we decided to try to find something that people they could relate to and something that was not just another business name like mattress something. So we decided to go with the name NOLA, and it's spelled N-O-L-A-H. So that's the website address, NOLAMattress.com. And there you have all the information that is relevant.
It's a great website. I went to it last night. Don?
Thank you.
Nola, but what is revolutionary about your mattress?
Good, very good question. And, you know, the easiest answer is that every other mattress here is made with memory foam. So if you go out to a mattress store or you go online and you want to buy a foam mattress, because that's what we do. We do foam mattresses, not spring mattresses. But if you want a foam mattress, everybody else is using outdated technology that was invented by NASA back in the 70s. And I'm referring to memory foam. A lot of people, they know memory foam. They've tried memory foam. And they would also find out that memory foam has a couple of downsides, that it sleeps hot and it's not that durable, so it starts to sag over time when you use it. Those two issues we have solved by using a new breed of foam. So we're not using memory foam, which is an outdated technology as everybody else is using. We're using the next iteration of memory foam, which is a new breed of foam that is rapidly gaining popularity because it has the same comfort as memory foam, but it does not sleep hot and is much more durable. So that's actually the biggest difference. We do not use the same foam as everybody else. We use something that is newer, more modern, and is more technology advanced than what you would normally find. So it's basically a better foam to make a better mattress that is solving the issues that you normally find with memory foam, sleeping too hot and not being that durable.
Well, so in effect, you don't compete with the innerspring mattress, but you compete in the mattresses in the foam area. Am I correct?
That's absolutely correct. And just for your listeners to understand, is that spring mattresses is roughly half of the market, and then the remaining 50% is actually sleeping on foam. So when you talk about mattresses, there's two types of people. There's those that sleeps on conventional spring mattresses, and then there's the other half, which is sleeping on foam mattresses. And we are reinventing the whole segment of foam mattresses.
Dan, I'll toss it back to you. I know you had another question.
Yeah, I have just a couple more. I was fascinated about your packaging. You ship in your mattress is kind of rolled up and put in a cardboard box and shipped by United Parcel. What I'm curious as to, as Don just mentioned about innerspring mattresses, was it NASA that caused the revolution that created your industry? People were not getting good REM level sleep off of coil springs. What caused your new generation of mattresses to evolve?
That's actually a good question, and you know I'm the perfect guy to ask that question too because I know the whole story. So I'm going to shorten it up a bit. What you see of foam mattresses today is actually correctly as you're stating, the memory foam that you see today were invented by NASA in the 1970s as a material to mitigate the force of G's. So the G-force that the astronauts, they were experienced when they were launching in a rocket. So it's a bit like science, like rocket science, actually. But NASA invented a type of foam that they called memory foam to prevent the astronaut being so affected by the G-force by launching. So the memory foam that you see today was not invented for sleep. It was invented for a completely other application. But after NASA, they saw, okay, this is actually something new and interesting. They gave it free to the public. And when it was given free to the public in the, you know, the late 70s, the early 80s, a company out of Sweden, actually, that were doing foam already for other applications, they took it in and saw that this could actually be a foam used for sleeping applications. So that was how the foam invented by NASA actually went into the sleep industry by a company that took it and ran with it. That company today is known as Tempur-Pedic, and a lot of people know that company. So that's actually how a space technology went into the consumer field of mattresses. And after Tempur-Pedic went in and did these memory foam mattresses as one of the first company that did it, it just gained immense popularity almost overnight. And it has been like that ever since. And the memory foam today, which is very, very similar to exact same technology that we used 40 years ago. And this is why we are saying that we're reinventing the foam and the memory and the foam mattresses, because if you go out and buy a mattress today of memory foam, you're buying outdated technology that hasn't really been reinvented for over 30 years. And, you know, today we're obsessed with the newest technology. Every time a new product comes out, everybody runs down to the store because they want the latest technology. And still, we're buying technology that are decades old for our beds.
Right.
Personally, if you ask me, I don't think it makes any sense. So that's why when we went into this year and we thought, okay, we're going to make a foam mattress because that's really a great mattress, we said, let's not go the same direction as everybody else. Let's invent something that is better and something that solves the issues that is with memory foam. And that was kind of our motivation, because we could just have done as everybody else, but then we would just be another memory foam mattress in a new sales and marketing package. We didn't want to do that, because everything that we do is something where we try to care for the customer's well-being. So we don't want to sell something that everybody's selling. We want to sell something that people come back to us and say, guys, what you did has actually improved my sleep and my overall well-being. And to do that, we just felt that it was necessary for us to do something new and better.
So let me go on to something we briefly touched about in the pre-show, and that is the importance of getting REM level sleep, not only for good restful sleep, but in the case of people with injuries or soldiers or veterans, REM level sleep is where the greatest amount of both psychological and physical healing takes place. Do you think that your new technology helps more people get to REM level sleep and staying there than the old style technology, including coil springs?
Yes, I actually do. And the reason why REM sleep is important, as you say yourself, it's where your body restores the most. And it's also where your brain restores itself, so that when you wake up, you feel well rested. You know, I think everybody knows the feeling of waking up in the middle of the night. If you haven't slept well, you don't feel well the day after. And to achieve this REM sleep, which is usually in the second half of the night, so when you go to sleep, you go into deep sleep where your body is paralyzed. So you're just lying there as a brick. You don't move. That's the deep sleep. After the deep sleep phase has finished, you go into REM sleep. And REM sleep is actually an acronym for rapid eye movement. So that's REM sleep. And the reason why you call it that is because the second half of the sleep, you move around. You're no longer paralyzed. So you move around, you turn sides, you shift your position. So the REM sleep is very active. And there's one notable fact that if you sleep too hot, meaning that your mattress overheats or that your bedroom temperature is too high, usually most people, they start to be affected in the REM sleep if they sleep hotter than 75, 76 Fahrenheit. So that's kind of the breaking point. So my point with this here is that our technology helps reduce mattresses overheating. And that is the most common reason for people to wake up during REM sleep and get disrupted during their REM sleep. So the only proven method to actually improve the REM sleep is by reducing the overheating in that phase of the sleep. And that's exactly what our mattress helps to do, because it's made as a temperature neutral mattress. And that's kind of the unique benefit of the NOLA mattress, is that it does not contain any of the heat sensitive chemicals that you find in memory foam. So yes, sleeping on our mattress and using the technology that we do will improve the REM sleep in the sense that it's going to reduce the overheating that is usually the most common reason for people to wake up during the REM sleep and get that part of the sleep disrupted. So the short answer is yes.
That's terrific. Don?
Well, my question is, how did you finance your company? How long has it been in business? And where are you located?
That's a really good question as well. We're located out of Denver, Colorado. So everything that we do is done from Denver here in Colorado. And we do the manufacturing across 8 plants. So we have a pretty big manufacturing in place. We don't own the manufacturing ourselves. What we do is that we do the technology, the processes. We do the benefit so that we make sure that we make product that actually works. So that's kind of how we do that. The funding of the company, and since this is a radio show for small businesses, the funding itself, we're actually funding everything ourselves. This is not our first business. So this time here, we were lucky that we have the comforter and pillow business that we've been doing for more than 10 years to actually fund what we're doing here with the NOLA mattress. So we're in a bit in a special position because we're successful entrepreneurs, successful business owners, so that we're funding everything ourselves. And this time here, we're not taking in any outside funding right now. We're in a pretty good position being cash flow positive and able to fund everything ourselves using our own money.
Hmm. Did you say you're outside of Aspen, or where in Colorado are you?
In Denver, downtown Denver.
Ah.
So, yeah. Downtown Denver, right in front of the mountains.
Well, then, how do people learn about you?
Everything is actually online today. So people learn from us on Facebook, on Google. When they browse, searching for a mattress online, you know, there are review sites that are specialized in reviewing mattresses. So people, pardon?
What is the most effective way of getting people to make that final decision to buy? Is it social media? Is it online? Is it your website? What is it that really makes people buy?
We can go down a bit in that. But what makes people buy is, first of all, the positioning in the market. So people buy our mattress because of one simple fact. It's not memory foam like everybody else. People really like that because most people that are buying a foam mattress, they're not coming from a spring mattress. They're actually people that already sleep on foam. So they have already made the decision that they want to sleep on foam. So they're probably sleeping on foam mattresses already. So as soon as you tell them that this is not memory foam, they say, wow, okay, that's good. Let me listen more. So that's the first important thing. The market position and the communication needs to be very clear so people understand how it's different and how it's better. When that is communicated to people on Facebook and Google and those review sites that we work with online, it's what we call the remarketing that actually makes people convert from just people that browse around the site to people that actually make a purchase. And for those of you listening that is unfamiliar with retargeting or something or sometimes called remarketing, it's basically that we serve ads online on Facebook, on Google, and you know all the big news sites that is out there that people read anyway, where we kind of tell people, hey, you know, you already been on our site. Did you know that the mattress can also do this and this and this? If not, come back and have a look again. So we're constantly pulling people back to our website to make sure that they get all the information that they need to make a decision, but that we don't give all the information in one go because it's going to be too much. So to answer a question that I know a lot of small business owners, they want to know, how many times do you talk to one of these customers? How many times do you engage them online before they make a purchase? And the answer to that is roughly 5 to 7 times. So that means that from the time a person sees NOLA first time online until they actually make a purchase, they usually been in contact with us through an ad on Facebook, through a ad on Google, or they have contacted us, or they've been on the website 5 to 7 times. When they've been engaged with us at that level, that's when they convert into a customer that makes a purchase.
Dan?
I have one just, we have about a minute left, and I wanted to ask this question. You were very specific in the beginning, indicating that this mattress is only available in the United States. Why is that?
That's because, that's actually a really good question as well. It's because I have a background doing European retail. And in Europe, when you sell to all the big box retailers, you have to deal with 26 different countries and markets. In the U.S., we can make one mattress that fits all 50 states because it's the same regulation, it's the same mattress sizes. So that's why we made one mattress for the U.S. market, and that's easier for us to manage than, for example, managing 50 different sizes of mattresses as we do for other regions of the world. So the Nola mattress is a U.S.-specific market. It's made in the U.S. 100%, and everything that is done with the Nola mattress is for U.S. only. It's American-made, and we're very proud to support U.S. jobs. So that's actually why. We wanted to make it a 100% to the bone and with the heart U.S. mattress.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. Give your website one more time. We'll put it on our website with a link to there, but just tell our listeners today if they decide they want to go and look it up right now, what's the website?
Sure. The website is Nola Mattress. So it's nolamattress.com. And Nola is spelled N-O-L-A-H mattress. And it's just one word, nolamattress.com. Everything is there for you to check out.
Danielle, could I just ask one more question, which just came across my my computer from a listener. Do you just have one size? Are you twins? Are you a regular size, queen, king? What are the sizes of your mattresses?
We have all standard sizes. So you can get the twin, the twin XL, the full, the queen, the king, and we even have the big Cal King mattress. So any standard U.S. mattress size.
Well, let me just ask one more quick question. You can actually ship a king-size mattress via UPS?
Yes, it's pretty amazing. But yeah, we can. We're using a very innovative technology to compress the mattress, roll it up, and we put it in a box. So, and then we ship it out. It's pretty amazing because when you open the box and you roll out the mattress, it poops off. It literally sucks in air, and then it becomes full size on your bed. It's pretty amazing to watch.
Well, that's truly amazing. I'm sorry, Dan. The email came across the desk. Danielle, your site again?
Yes.
When you sign off.
Sure. It's called Nola Mattress, N-O-L-A-H mattress.com.
Well, thank you for joining us, and good luck with your business, and we'll talk off the air about how we can help some soldiers. So thank you for joining us, Danielle.
Thank you for inviting me, and have a good day, and wish you all the best. Thank you.
Thank you. And
Don't
now
when you get your data. Email is insecure and can't handle large files. Instead, use Biscom's Secure File Transfer product. Military-grade security that's as easy to use as email, and it can handle attachments of any size. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial and make sure your private communications stay private. That's BISCOM.com.
Sorry about that. That was our...
Welcome back to Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful. Now it's time for Money in Motion. Dan Perkins is our resident expert in making the money you earn work as hard as you do. Here is Dan Perkins.
Dan, I'm going to interrupt you and ask you, since we're on the subject of sleep and since it's so dear to your heart, Will you tell our audience a little bit about your philanthropy and what you're doing? Because you've had a couple of milestones recently, and I just think they should know a little bit more of what's going on.
We have a foundation that my wife and I established about a little over 2 years ago called Songs and Stories for Soldiers. And the website is songsandstoriesforsoldiers.us. We have been working in the area of helping veterans in 63 facilities across the United States, whether they be hospitals, homeless shelters, outpatients, whatever it is, deal with the post-traumatic stress disorder. And the implications, first and foremost, is through sleep deprivation, meaning they don't get to REM level sleep, or they're not at REM level sleep long enough to recharge the body. And that leads to deterioration of the thinking process and lead to suicide in some cases. The suicide rate for male veterans is about four times their contemporaries in the private sector. And the most astonishing number is that female veterans have a suicide rate 12 times their contemporaries. We have about 2.1 million female veterans in the United States, and the VA is telling us, as best they can determine, there may be as many as 600,000 women with PTSD. So when our guest was talking about getting to REM sleep and dealing with temperature, my ears perked up, because we're always looking for anything that can help the soldier veteran get a better quality of sleep. So we'll look at and talk with him after the show to see what we might be able to do to help at least get his research out and let other people know what's going on to try and help more and more soldiers. As I said, we crossed 63 facilities, and we now have over 11,000 MP3 players that have been distributed. That has a couple of novels, but most importantly, it has an 8-hour custom-designed sleep audio designed to try and help the soldier get to REM-level sleep. And we get about 30 to 32,000 hits a month on our website. So we're doing our best to try and help those who've given up so much for us. And I'm excited about this NOLA mattress concept. Back to you, sir.
Well, I couldn't let you do the program without following up. Do you have some other thoughts on small business before we have our next guest on?
Is our next guest ready to go?
He's ready to go.
Let's go ahead and bring them on, and then we'll see if we have some time.
Okay. Gene Unger is on the line. He's one of the most fascinating guests I think we'll have in a long time. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Good evening, Gene. This is Dan Perkins. How are you?
Hey, Dan. I'm doing well. Thanks. How about yourself?
I'm very well. Thank you.
Good.
Thank you for joining us today.
Sure.
Why don't you tell us a little and our listeners a little bit about you and the name and website for your business and how you got started?
Yeah, wow. That's a great question. So I work for a firm called Commerce Street Capital. They're based in Dallas, Texas. The website is www.commercestreetcapital, just like it sounds, .com.
Mm-hmm.
So we're a full-service investment bank. We do mergers and acquisitions, so we help business owners sell and monetize their business. We help businesses buy other businesses, and then we help businesses raise capital or financing or anything sort of in the raising money realm. We also do a bunch of valuation work and some other just general advisory work. Most of the managing directors, including myself, sit on boards of companies and just are constantly giving CEOs, CFOs, and boards just solid advice on whether it's growth or decisions they're making in their businesses, because many times, as a lot of times senior management is not getting the the information and the advice they really need, because employees are, you know, afraid to speak up or perhaps give them bad news that they otherwise just don't want to hear. So we try to provide those kinds of services as well.
How long have you been in business?
Commerce Street's been in business since about, I think, 1986.
Wow.
I've been doing this for about 15 years. We have about 60 professionals, not all in the Dallas office, but that's where our headquarters is, and that's mm-hmm. where most of the professionals are.
I have one more question before we turn it over to Don. The reason why we started this particular show was because we believe that with the change in administration, there was going to be an opportunity for almost an explosion of small businesses. And we think that that's beginning to happen. The data that we've been seeing is that there are businesses for sale and a growing number of businesses starting. So what dynamics are you seeing today that are different than what they were, say, 6 months ago?
Yeah, God, it's a great question. I mean, it's depending on where you look. I mean, we are seeing a lot of people, you know, starting businesses, but we're also seeing a lot of businesses just grow. I spoke recently on CNBC and was talking about, you know, M&A and the Trump administration, and one of the things that I think we're seeing is just capitulation amongst business owners to, you know, I call it diversify their wealth, but to, you know, to monetize their businesses. Because, you know, anytime the Dow is at 20, 21,000, valuations are just really, really high. And mm-hmm. as we've all seen in business, you know, there's the argument, well, you hold on a little bit longer and see where it goes, but we've all seen kind of ebbs and flows in the market and ebbs and flows in valuation. So we're just seeing a lot of business owners, you know, sort of dip their toe into the water to see, you know, what their business perhaps is worth, what kind of buyers are out there. And as it turns out, there's a lot, right? You have, you know, dry powder, which means that, you know, private equity funds have capital that they have not deployed yet, and there's a competition amongst them to find good, solid businesses. And so as a result, they're willing to pay more, generally speaking, than you might otherwise get in a normal capital environment. So the trends that we're seeing is when you look at the potential of tax reform, you look at infrastructure spending or the proposal of more infrastructure spending and just general positive business climate in the Trump administration, I think it's a very positive thing for businesses and in what we do in M&A.
Go ahead, Don.
Well, I want to ask Gene, how does someone who owns a small business prepare a small business to be acquired?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, there's several things that, you know, one can do. And, you know, it includes, you know, just, I mean, the big key to everything is making sure that you are prepared. Because what happens is that if you're not prepared, that can create an issue in, you know, your particular valuation. So here are some of the things that I think about, right, when preparing to sell a business is, one, just understanding from a valuation standpoint what your company is worth, right? Because there's times where we go into a situation where, you know, the CEO thinks the business is worth $100 million and, you know, from our perspective, it's 50, and we're miles apart. I mean, one of the things that we do is we make sure that, you know, we are data-based. So what I mean by that is that if we come up with a valuation or we help a CEO or a board come up with a prospective valuation on their business, you know, we're using data points that, you know, when someone else is reviewing this company, we can say, hey, look, this is what we think the value is worth, and here are data points to show that. Now, we may get more than that, and someone may be willing to pay more than we've seen historically, but we try to use data points, and there's a lot of data points out there to come up with a valuation. Secondly is to make sure that your books are in order. You know, that's very, very, very important, because when companies, when companies look at your business, you know, they want to see a company that's sophisticated, that have their books in order, they understand their business. You know, if the manufacturing company, do they understand price per SKU? You know, do they understand what all the ledger items are? Where are our expenses going out? Where are the revenues coming in? Those kinds of things. Because if someone's going to get a great value for their business, the one of the ways they're going to do that is if someone's going to pay more money for your company, they want to know that you are well-run and sophisticated. If you're not well-run and you don't have your books in order, you're not going to get a premium for your business. And that is ultimately what you want. You know, just getting your paperwork organized, right? Because what will happen is if you go into a potential sale, you know, the prospective buyer is going to want to see a bunch of documentation. And if it takes you 2 months to get it, again, that's a signal that you just don't know your business or you're not prepared, whether it's, you know, corporate documents or financials or, you know, you're building lease or, you know, contracts with clients or customers, distribution, and so on. You know, get an advisory team in place, right? You know, understanding what the process is. You know, it's never our recommendation for a business owner to just handle the sale himself or herself. And the reason is because it's like selling a home, right? I mean, someone can walk up to your front door and say, you know, hello, sir, I want to buy your house for X, but maybe it's worth more than X. Maybe it's worth Y. And so you want to run a process to, you know, create some excitement to get people to bid on your business. And if you have 6 or 7 potential buyers, you're going to have people paying more than they otherwise would if it was just a single person for a single transaction.
Gene, one of the things that's I'm interested in your perspective, a lot of people talk about that this, my generation, the baby boomers, are going to represent the greatest wealth transfer in the history of this country. And we have a lot of post-World War II men and women who started businesses in many different fields who are now reaching retirement age and are looking to possibly sell their businesses. But one option that we could explore is whether or not an ESOP makes sense as a way to sell your business.
Yeah, it's definitely a possibility. It's depending on the type of business too, will depend on whether an ESOP makes a lot of sense. It's definitely, and it sort of depends, right? I mean, if you're looking for something, some kind of monetization of the business, you're not going to receive all of the worth of the business upon closing of the transaction because of the way the ESOP is set up. It's more or less kind of a loan to the business. So, you know, you have a note and you have, you know, the CEO or the business owner kind of on the hook for that loan, right? Because you're basically issuing shares to your employees. Mm-hmm. And so there's a huge responsibility of the CEO to sort of maintain the integrity of that ESOP, i.e. the financial worth, the credit worthiness of that ESOP. Mm-hmm. And so if a CEO is looking to just, you know, take, you know, $50 million and run, an ESOP is not the way to do it. It's also very complicated. It's very difficult to maintain. There's just a lot of work involved in doing that. But, you know, that being said, it's definitely an option. It's just a very complicated and legal intensive document or a process. In addition to that, you know, you need evaluation every quarter because, you know, if an employee leaves, you know, you need to buy back their shares. So you got to price, you know, what the ESOP shares are worth. And so there's just a lot of work involved.
Well, you talked about the service of some of the services in following up Don's question. Do you help a small business get their house in order up front before you begin to look for possible buyers?
Oh, yeah, you know, absolutely. I mean, so the way our process generally works is you know, obviously there's a due diligence stage, you know, ahead of getting engaged with a client. So, you know, those conversations are learning about the company, you know, finding out kind of where they've been, where they're at, where they're going. Do the personalities fit? Do they want to work with us and do we want to work with them? What are they looking to do? Is it a closable transaction? You know, are people realistic about the process and those kinds of things? And then once we're engaged, the way it typically works is that we send our client an information request list. And that's a document that, you know, here's all the information we need. And so what happens is by doing that, it makes them prepared because they have to prepare it for us. So some of the documents we request are for presentations that we have to put together. And that present one of the presentations is just what we call a SIM, but the SIM is essentially a presentation of the company on where they've been, where they're at, where they're going. So if someone, you know, if we send an email and say, hey, are you interested in buying this business, they can read this document and understand it and understand the business. The other thing that we create is a financial model. And that kind of serves two purposes, right? One is that if you're sending this out to prospective buyers and your, you know, last 5-year financials are in there, you have projections, your balance sheet, you know, line item by line item of your, you know, your ledger and so on, a prospective buyer will look at this and go, wow, like these guys really know their business. They're really prepared. You know, they really are sophisticated. But it also allows a prospective buyer to take that model and then manipulate it based on what they plan to do. So if they plan to buy the business, the capital structure is going to look different. So they're going to look at that and go, okay, well, if we put in $50 million and we put $25 million of equity and then 25 of debt, this is what the capital structure will look like and can, you know, how quickly can we pay that off, and we can adjust these expenses and, you know, projections look like this, and they can manipulate it, right? So it helps them, it speeds up the process and so on. And then, you know, then that's really where the discussions start, right? So prospective buyers will call us. And then they'll ask us questions about the business, and we'll answer them. And then, you know, we, you know, 50 people down to 12, and then we'll get those 12 in front of our client. We'll have more discussions. And then, you know, we'll get to more formal processes like an LOI and so on. But part of the reason we collect all that information is because at some point we're going to create a data room. And a data room is a warehouse of all the documentation of the business. So when a prospective buyer comes in, he can go into that that warehouse, that data room, and see all the documentation. So again, we are helping them in that sense. And we also, you know, take the burden off of them in selling this business. We also give them good advice, you know, avoiding the pitfalls, because there are unsavory people out there that just don't operate above board, you know, and just benefit from the things we've seen over time.
So are there businesses that are hot at the moment that are great candidates to sell?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. You know, I think in this environment, you know, there are some businesses that, you know, are, you know, hotter than others. But what I would tell you is that the way I answer the question is that a hot business is one that is very profitable and has historically always been profitable, right? That's what really drives buyers. So, you know, if you have a company that does, you know, 40% EBITDA, or 40% margins, you know, versus another company that does 10%, that 40% margin business is going to be much more appealing to prospective buyers. So, you know, when you look at historical growth and profitability, those are the two things that make a company hot or less hot. Now, there are certain sectors that, you know, people focus on, but for us, that doesn't make too much of a difference. I mean, you can look at any industry, manufacturing, healthcare, technology, consumer products. If you grow consistently and have decent profitability, depending on how much you've grown and how profitable you are, will make you less or more desirable to prospective buyers.
you think with the possibility of a, as some are saying, a true trillion dollar public-private infrastructure to rebuild the highways, the bridges, the tunnels, and the airports and schools. Does that change the evaluation potential for people in the construction business to build highways and bridges and tunnels and airports?
Yeah, I mean, no, there's no question. I mean, when you look at, when you look at just the comparable companies. So when you come up with a valuation, so say, you know, you and I own a manufacturing business, like a rebar business that, you know, is completely affected by freeway construction or infrastructure spending. You know, when we look at our valuation, we have to base that valuation on what the public comparable companies are doing, right? That's how you come up with a valuation. You look at the public comparables, you use their multiples and kind of compare yourself to them. Well, you know, if infrastructure comparable companies, infrastructure public companies are higher, then that inflates your valuation as well. So as a result, it does do that. Now, I think that there's some hesitation at this point on, you know, how that infrastructure spending is going to look and whether it's actually going to transpire. But I think everyone is pretty bullish about that. And, you know, look, there's a buyer for everybody, right? I mean, we do energy deals. And, you know, that's not the hottest space right now because oil prices are so depressed. But there are a lot of funds out there who are really willing to run into a building when it's on fire. But then there's also folks who want to jump on, you know, industries like infrastructure spending or infrastructure where, you know, they feel that there's a boon coming and, you know, they want to participate in what the Trump administration is going to be doing.
So this may not be the right comparison, but Caterpillar Tractor or John Deere might be a good play in the public sector to play for road construction, bridges, and tunnels. And that public sector will, in fact, are you saying the public sector will influence the price of a small business to sell in that space?
100%.
Don?
Can I jump in? I have two questions. One came over the internet, but as you may be aware, I sit on a medical marijuana nonprofit here in New Jersey. And my question is, do you think that medical marijuana will be a viable area in the next 2 or 3 years? Or do you think that, well, what do you think?
It's a good question. Again, this is my own opinion. I think it's further away. I think to have a real commerce, a real industry in place, I've seen people trying to get into this space and to create products and services around that. But I think it's further out than 2 years. I think it's probably closer 5 to 7 to have, you know, businesses that are really booming and, and participating in that. I think it's further out than 2 years, in my opinion.
Well let me ask the question that one of our listeners just sent in, which is, how do you deal with employees when you're thinking about or in the process of selling your business?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's something that we always think about in a process. And, you know, the bottom line is that you want to make sure you bring in the right buyer. So, you know, the CEO, you know, always has to remember that he or she holds the NUC codes in a deal. So, you know, CEO number one can come to us and say, hey, Gene, look, I want to sell my company, and I want $100 million. And I can come to them and say, hey, look, not only did I get you 100, I got you 50 million more, and really deliver in that sense. But, you know, they could meet with the buyer and just not like this person and go, wow, you know, this guy's looking to do this with my business and he's looking to do that and he's probably going to fire my CFO and my head of marketing and so on and so on. You know, that CEO can just say no, right? So what we try to do is to bring in the right buyers because there are very friendly buyers. And so when I had mentioned, you know, what the process looks like, well, part of the process, as I mentioned, was getting the CEO or the board or all of the above in front of the prospective buyer. And they sit down and talk. And one of those conversations or one of those questions in that conversation is going to be, what are you going to do with my employees, right? And then, you know, there's things that you can put in contractually that, you know, ensure that, you know, certain people stay. You know, you can have employee contracts, those kinds of things. But, you know, there are ways to do that, and those are probably the top two or three.
So, Gene, I have a follow-up question. We've got about 2 minutes left. I'm thinking about the small businessman who's had a successful business, very profitable, and for whatever reason, he or she decides they want to sell it. And you go out and you find him a great deal to sell his company. And 6 or 9 months later, they're all sitting around the table in your conference room and are signing all the documents and checks exchange hands. What does that person do the next morning when he doesn't have an office to go to? He doesn't have employees to work for. Isn't that a significant cultural shock for an entrepreneur who may have spent 30, 40 years building that business?
Yeah, gosh, that's a really, really good question. I mean, I would say typically there's a phase out. It's pretty rare where somebody buys a business, as you described, and the CEO the next day is just out of the picture. Typically, when someone buys a business, they'll want the CEO to stay on as an employee or a CEO or a consultant for, you know, anywhere from 3 months to 2 years.
Okay.
And so as a result, you know, that CEO then can phase out of the business and have it not be such a, you know, you're using more of a scalpel than a butcher knife in,
uh-huh.
in you know, in exiting that business. And so, you know, as a result, you know, there's a more easier phase out than it is just, you know, cold turkey.
Yeah. Don, any other questions you have?
Oh, well, I have to, one more, which is essentially deals with, what happens if the owner goes all the way to the deal and gets cold feet? Do you see that happen? And what are the reasons for that?
Yeah, it does happen, unfortunately, because, you know, you put in 6 months of work and you get the CEO what they want, and then they pull out. And obviously, you know, we're success-based, so we generally don't get paid unless the deal closes. So those are heartbreaking situations for us, as you can imagine, but they do happen. And the main reason I have seen this take place is, you know, there's just an emotional tie to that business, right? You know, it's many times people's identity. You know, when they go to dinner or they go to a club or they go to a meeting, it's Bill at XYZ company. And he's been that person for 30 years. And so now that person is no longer has that identity. And, you know, that's a hard pill to swallow for many people. You know, there's also just that emotional tie of just, you know, you've worked somewhere 30 years and you're used to the consistency of it. And, you know, you just don't want that to end. And, you know, so those are kind of the main two reasons that we see people pull out or not consummate deals.
Anything else, Don?
Well, lots more, but tell us, Gene, again, your company and how people reach you.
Yeah, so our firm is Commerce Street Capital. They can reach me directly two ways. One is my email address. So it's E as in Eugene Urcan, U-R-C-A-N. So E-U-R-C-A-N at C as in cat, street, cap, C-A-P.com. One more time, it's E-U-R-C-A-N at C, street, C-A-P.com. They can also just reach me directly on my mobile phone. It's 626-840-4288. Again, 626-840-4288.
Well, Gene, thank you for being on the show. It was very insightful, and I'm sure our audience learned a great deal. So we'll be right back after these messages from our sponsor.
Hate your old fax machine? You can now fax through email. Simply write an email, attach the document, and send. Works with all major email providers. Get rid of the noisy and expensive old fax machine and try Biscom's Cloud Fax. Our solutions are great for businesses of all sizes. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial. That's BISCOM.com.
Ben, our next guest is somebody I'm really glad we have on board. Gary Malloy is president of Money Mailers, and I happen to think it's one of the best ways a small business can market their products. Gary, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Gary, this is Dan Perkins. I want to extend my welcome to our program. I'm anxious to hear about your business. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the business and how people can reach you, and then we'll talk about other issues.
Terrific. Well, I got involved with this business because I fell in love with it, actually, when I was running a different company and spoke to the founder of this business and tried to buy it, actually. and we were unable to come to much like what your prior person on the show with you was talking about. He just couldn't see selling the business at the point in time that I was trying to buy it. He'd founded it. The business did eventually sell, and I discovered in late 2009 that it was available, and I lined up some people to help me buy the business. So I actually bought the business myself in 2010 and have been running it since July of 2010 because it's a fascinating business that is focused on helping Americans create a business. We are a franchise model, so we are helping people create live the American dream by founding their own business and their own family asset of a small business themselves. And then in turn, they make a living by helping other people be successful as small business owners and again fulfill the American dream. So it's a wonderful company, and it's a company I love. So I can be reached. Yeah,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say I can be reached directly at my office line is 714-889-3839. That's 714-889-3839, and I can answer anybody's questions about either joining us as a franchisee or how we might be able to help them succeed in their own small business.
So how long have you owned the company?
Since July of 2010, coming up on 7 years.
7 years. And let's tell our listeners exactly what it is you do, your company.
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, we operate through owner-operated franchises that are basically marketing consultants for small business. And those small businesses can range from an individual retail outlet, such as a dry cleaner or a restaurant, up to market-wide home improvement companies, replacement windows, garage doors, general contractors that might cover the entire city of Chicago, for instance. And for all of those small businesses, we basically provide a marketing consultancy of a small business owner to small business owner relationship. And we provide advertising services primarily through direct mail, a shared package, an envelope, if you will, that you share space with another 30 or 40 small businesses in the locale. And we mail those ads, and those ads take different forms depending on the nature of the client, to 10,000 households. So because it's a shared relationship, it's a very, very low-cost investment in creating demand for those small businesses. We also have our own website where we also feature our clients and a mobile app that consumers download to actually check on offers in the locale they happen to be in that day. But the primary service we provide is the direct mail envelope at a very low cost of 3 to 4 cents per household.
I'm sitting here listening. I have a student of mine, an ex-student of mine, that was a money mailer franchisor for many years, who now happily retired. He retired before I did, ironically. I happen to believe so much in print. Even though my livelihood now is online, I'm still a print. But what I like about the money mailer concept is you're putting paper in the hands of people at a time in their home, and that's something that no one else can guarantee. And Gary, tell us a little bit more about how that works. If our listeners haven't figured out by now, I'm very much for this product because I know it works, and I think small businesses in the rush to do social media have sometimes forgotten how important this is, particularly local small businesses.
Exactly. We are what I like to call a primary demand creator, and there aren't many advertising mediums that are primary demand creators. And what I mean is that I and my company, we drive people to social media sites. We drive people to to a small business's website. The traffic, historically the response that we could drive was either telephone calls or visits to a retail location. But today, the response we're generating is hugely shifting to social media response and website visits. We still create those conventional ones of the phone call and the store visit, the retail location visit. But the reality is that the response level we generate now is much higher than historically it was because there's so many new venues that the consumers can move to. And what our clients do is use us to drive to their social media sites and to drive people to their websites. And I think that's the important thing for a small business owner to remember. You need to have demand created in order for people to know to go to your social media site or to your website.
Well, that's very true. We had somebody recently on a program that said in order for them to sell their product, in this case, a sponge mattress, that they had to engage someone 5 to 7 times, and that exactly. Seems to be the magic words, the magic thing. Now we know in business, it's 7 to 9, and around 7 times. So it's just not one time; it's multiple times. And if I'm hearing you right, you're saying you can be a primary one to start the chain.
Exactly, and the reality is that our small business clients realize that a single ad is not really what their commitment is to our product. Our product works, as you're saying, on having a frequency of 3 or 4 times in a call to action. We see response, for instance, for our small businesses from an ad that will have run in March. A consumer will actually take action on it in June and July, and we know that through call tracking and URL tracking and so forth. We know when they take the response and from what ad they are actually taking the response. And people are sold sometimes on services that they don't need immediately, but they are storing that information away for when they do need to replace a window, or when they do need to have a carpet cleaned, or when they do have an interest in trying a new restaurant. So people do store our ads away. It's another beauty of print is that we end up, it might sound funny, but we end up on refrigerators, and we end up in envelopes, and we end up in drawers where people are saving things that are of interest to them, if you know what I'm saying. And that's the beauty of print, is that it's easily saved and easily stored and easily used.
So, Gary, what is the economics in a franchisee? How do they make money, and how much money can they make?
Well, franchisees, make a variety of income levels depending on how large the territory is they want to work and how hard they want to work. And so we have people that range in their gross profits, if you will, from anywhere from 75 to 100,000 up to people that are making $500,000 a year. And again, it depends on the motivation and the perseverance and so forth, and also the length of time they've been doing it. We have franchisees that are joining us today. We're growing pretty rapidly right now at a clip of 10 to 20% a year in numbers of franchisees. But we've had franchisees that have been with us for 25, 30, 35 years. Obviously that experience level also contributes to a more aggressive business style. Franchisees make, they make a living by actually consulting and developing long-term business relationships with other small business operators. And the beauty of our system and the uniqueness of it, because there aren't other national companies like ours that provide a very cost-efficient process designed to have a small business operator working with a small business owner. And that owner-to-owner relationship is one of the things that sets us apart and actually gives us a much greater credibility, I think, with the client small business operator, because they're dealing with another local small business person.
If I understand your business model correctly, and I may not, but I might, the franchisee is responsible for establishing relationships in their local community or franchise territory and creating relationships where they have people that give them an opportunity to put their story in the packet.
Exactly. And then everything else from there is pretty much a turnkey operation. The small business owner that's the client basically has to do very little other than agree to what the terms of the ad are that they want to run. It can be an offer, it can be a coupon, or it can be simply an informational piece about the service or product they provide. And then the franchisee will work with us to design an ad. The small business owner will approve the ad. Everything else is handled for them. We help them design the area, the physical geographic profile that is optimum for them based upon data. So we target the most affluent households in neighborhoods around that business, and we help them decide which areas of the geography, in fact, have the greatest propensity to buy that particular product or service. So we help them target the most opportune households, and we do all of that, like I said, for around 3 or 4 cents a household. It's a very economical way to reach a key target audience, it's simple. It's very simple and turnkey.
Don?
What are the types of stores or local businesses that you found have been most effective using money mailers?
Yeah, absolutely. The highest consumer interest category we have in our envelope are restaurants, but we have everything from entertainment, which can be anything from bowling alleys and miniature golf to theaters, movie theaters, dry cleaners, nail salons, hair salons, automotive services, home improvement companies such as replacement windows, general contractors, carpet cleaning, landscaping and handyman services. So a huge variety of local businesses. And again, part of the beauty of being in our envelope is that the client is in almost a shopping center, if you will, that a consumer is perusing, because they know that we contain all of this local content. And that if they don't look, they're passing on savings opportunities in their own local neighborhood. Most consumers are only going to drive 3 or 4 miles to conduct their family business, whether that's a restaurant or go to a dry cleaner or go to a food store or whatever. And, you know, we're known to consumers. We're red, white, and blue, and they perceive that to mean that we support local business, which we do. And when we have a 95% open rate as a result. When we arrive in the household, we are a valued shopping center, if you will, of offers and information.
Well, what types of offers work? I mean, a free dessert, a free appetizer, dollar amounts. What are some of the things that work in your offerings?
Yeah, one of the interesting things is that obviously we've compiled across the United States for every category that we do business in, what kind of offers actually are the most successful. And so we can actually provide that information on a very specific basis for every individual kind of client, the small business operator that we speak with. And what we find in general is that consumers need to see the clear value of the offer, so that it's best to express things in terms of absolutes, in terms of dollars, as opposed to percentages. Percentages are only good if you know what the basis for the cost is, so that 10% off assumes that they know what the value is that they're going to be paying, which they don't. And but $10 off is a much more meaningful and a stronger statement. So we recommend that if you're going to make an offer of some kind to a consumer, that it be as specific in terms of dollar value as possible.
Dan, do you have a question?
I do. I wanted to ask Gary about what does it cost to set up a franchise, and what would a typical territory look like?
Yeah, a typical territory is generally 50,000 households. We speak of them as zones. Our geographic unit is a zone of 10,000 households that have been specially selected to be the highest income and the most the highest level of education and multiple car ownership and home ownership. So we are known to our clients as providing an affluent consumer audience. That's by design across the United States. So we do not mail every household in a geography. We're selective because we know that that is what's going to get the best return for on investment for our clients. The franchise cost is basically $87,000. It's a non brick and mortar franchise. There's very little other investment costs to get started. We have a very attractive program that helps franchisees get through the initial 2-year startup period called the GPS program. And if anyone's interested, they can reach out to our company and we'll explain that to them. It's very innovative and very unique in the franchise industry, but we are a low investment franchise that is basically owner operated and operated out of a home. So the investment is low and the potential earnings are strong.
Gary, it appears that maybe I'm oversimplifying what's going on, but it sounds like that the franchisee is responsible for attracting and servicing the client relationships. Yet your company provides all of the paper, the mailing, the packaging, and the creative. Does the franchisee pay a fee for that too?
Yes, the franchisee will pay a cost for fulfilling their mailing. That includes the cost of the individual ads that they do. The cost of postage, obviously, for the postal delivery of the envelope itself. They pay some additional costs for insertion of the ads into the envelope and for creative, for targeting. But it's all packaged and very clear, from an overhead standpoint, as to what the cost of each mailing is. Their responsibility, frankly, is to develop and acquire a client base that they service and advise. And what we do is we provide them the help to execute the program to make that worry-free, if you will, so that basically, you know, we execute for both the client and the franchisee the program in a consistent, high-quality way and a timely way. We promise the date. We deliver the package on that date to the households of the consumers. And it's an easy system to be a part of.
Do you find that the companies that sign up with your franchisee have good retention capabilities?
Yes. No, we have very long-term relationships with most of our franchisees. Have people that they've worked with for, if they've been in business 25 years, they have clients that have been with them 20, 25 years. And some of them return on a seasonal basis. As I said, some of our businesses are landscapers that might be only in the spring and early summer each year, but they are there part of the year and not all year. Some people are there every single mailing throughout the year. And so it varies. Some people come in and out a bit. Some small business operators kind of do their marketing, if you will, on a sporadic basis as opposed to a year-round basis that larger companies might do. And we have relationships of all kinds with small businesses. And it's, I just talked to a franchisee the other day that just, rekindled a relationship with someone that had been a client 8 years ago and had wandered off and not done business with him for a while. And he called them up one day and just said, "Hey, I'm still here. Would I could build some business for you?" And they went, I think that's a great idea. So the relationships have all kinds of forms. And as I said, the franchisees have a geographic responsibility and ownership that they basically, they develop that client base. And the rest of the business transaction we try to make as easy as possible for them.
So when you start, when the business was started, you basically were in the business of driving people into the merchant's store or restaurant or cleaners or whatever.
Right.
Now, if it sounds like what you're saying in answer to Don's question is that you're spending more time now driving people to websites and social media, not so much driving them in the stores.
Well, we still are driving them into stores. It's interesting. The research we've done shows that we're sending as many people to phone calls and to store visits as we always have, but now we're also creating huge numbers of people that are visiting websites and social media sites. And so our response has changed in the nature of the response because we have more avenues that we can drive it to. And it's kind of interesting to look at. Our clients you see an increase in the response, if you will, if they track all of the URL and activity. So,
okay, Don.
Well, we have about 1 minute left. I was just going to say, one of the key ingredients it would appear for a franchisee is the ability to get out there and talk to people and sell people.
Right.
Am I correct in that?
Absolutely correct. And so we look for people who like being with people, they like interacting, they enjoy working with people every day and trying to help them be successful. And that's the key component that we look for in looking for a franchisee.
Gary, I guess the last question is: tell people again your website and how people can reach you.
Right, exactly. Our website is moneymailer.com. It can be a site that people go to as a consumer looking for offers, or for someone who's interested, a small business owner that is interested in contacting a local franchisee that'll hook them up directly. Or someone who's interested in becoming a franchisee. Or they can just call me at 714-889-3839. And that either one of those will work.
Well, Gary Malloy, thank you so much for being with us. I believe so much in your concept. I hope our audience learned a little bit more and enjoy it as much as I do. Thank you.
Great. Great. Thanks very much. Hopefully I was interesting.
Take care. It was.
Very good. Take care. Thanks. I enjoyed it. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Well,
do we
have one more commercial
left? Email is insecure and can't handle large files. Instead, use Biscom's Secure File Transfer product. Military-grade security that's as easy to use as email, and it can handle attachments of any size. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial and make sure your private communications stay private. That's BISCOM.com. Don't let hackers get your data. Email is insecure and can't handle large files. Instead, use Biscom's Secure File Transfer product. Military-grade security that's as easy to use as email, and it can handle attachments of any size. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial and make sure your private communications stay private. That's BISCOM.com.
Welcome back to Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful. Now it's time for Money in Motion. Dan Perkins is our resident expert in making the money you earn work as hard as you do. Here is Dan Perkins.
Well, Don, I just saw come across my screen that Russia makes an enormous troop and artillery movement to the North Korean border. So now we have about 150,000 Chinese troops at the North Korean border. They're not saying how many Russian troops, just the word enormous for both troops and artillery. It seems that that Russia and China are surrounding North Korea. And while I can't see the markets because I'm on the show with you, my guess is that they're not necessarily thrilled with that. I would expect to see probably gold probably up and interest rates down as there's a flight to quality to U.S. Treasuries. There's a lot of discussion this week in terms of volatility of corporations meeting or missing earnings. Goldman, for example, they use the word a rare miss for Goldman Sachs, and the market sold off on that. Now, Verizon this morning also missed. So there doesn't seem to be stability yet in earnings growth across the board. And as our guests have talked about, especially our investment banker friend, stability of earnings and profitability are extremely important. Well, you know what? Not only are they important for a small business valuation, they're extremely important for large corporations that are listed on exchanges that are seeking investors to buy their shares. We received a notice yesterday that the Department of Labor, and this is really important to small business people, the Department of Labor proposed regulations presented by the Obama administration on the relationship between brokers and transaction fees, which was to go into effect April the 9th, was postponed and under review until, I believe, May 6th. But what I'm hearing on the street is, regardless of the outcome of the review on the part of the Department of Labor, there is a great possibility that many of the Main Street, Wall Street brokerage firms are going to force their retirement account clients into a fee-based model, which instead of charging commission per transaction, will charge an asset management fee equal to the amount of commissions that may have been paid over the previous 24 months, and that will be charged on a monthly basis. It's interesting to me to hear people in the brokerage industry, and if we understand brokerage, meaning it's brokering a transaction between buyers and sellers, are saying they no longer want a brokerage compensation model, that they want to be paid a fee. I think that the problem that I'm having with that is that a small business person who has a modest 401k or SEP IRA may find himself paying actually more in the fee structure than he was paying in the commissions that he was used when he was making trades. And so I believe the costs potentially are going to go up. And in somebody like myself, who's a registered investment advisor, I'm not a broker, so I don't earn commissions. It really puts pressure on my clients to focus on transaction costs when what's more important is not so much how much you paid for something, but what is it that you're buying. Now, I understand, having been on Wall Street for 40 plus years, there are people out there who churn and burn and sell people inappropriate investments. And that's not only true of Wall Street, but we just saw Wells Fargo go through a major problem of false accounts and trying to earn compensation. What concerns me is that we've got the federal government trying to decide what the relationship will be between a customer and the professional that they want to hire. I think that's a really bad thing. But I think from what I'm hearing yesterday, regardless of how the Department of Labor is going to rule in May, we're going to see more and more firms go to an advisory fee and eliminate, quote, the transaction. And they're not really eliminating, they're just recasting it as a different structure. Now, if there is a silver lining in this sow's ear, is that currently, unless changed under federal tax law, currently advisory fees are a deductible expense, an itemized deduction. Commission fees are only come into play when a transaction is sold, not when they're purchased. And so they are an adjustment of basis. What you're going in commission and you're coming out commission helps adjust the basis of the transaction. Advisory fees, which are based on assets, which is what the street is proposing, is a fee and therefore tax deductible. And depending upon your tax rate, because it's tax deductible, you get it write it off now as opposed to waiting some time in the future when you sell an asset that you own. So I'm cautiously concerned about how this is going to change. And I'm not sure that you may not see a revolution of a lot of retirement account customers moving to companies like TD Ameritrade and Charles Schwab and other brokerage firms who are not in the business of selling packaged products, but are in the business of execution. I know I'm thinking about it seriously for my clients. What am I going to do if, in fact, regardless of how the Department of Labor turns out, because I have money in brokerage accounts all over the street, what am I going to do? Am I going to move these accounts to a broker that basically is in the transaction business? And that has pluses and minuses. I'm concerned about how it will impact my ability to do business, my ability to get the things that I want from my clients. There's no perfect advisor, no perfect broker, but I think when you change the basic fundamentals of how the business works, you're going to create problems. And I think while it may be cracked, it isn't totally broken, and there are things that can be done to make it safer for the American consumer. But it's a big change that could be coming in the next couple of months, and I'm watching it very carefully. And as I get any other information, I'll certainly update people on our show. So that's all I've got for now, and we got less than a minute to go. So I'm Dan Perkins.
This is Don Mazzella. So glad you can join us. It's been a fascinating show today, and our next one I think people are gonna like even more. Thank you,
and we'll see you next week. Our next guest is James H. Lee, a long and successful track record in investment management and research. He is a certified financial planner, a chartered financial analyst, and a chartered market technician. He's got a lot of initials after his name.
You don't have the quote.
James has gained media attention as the Delaware's only professional futurist.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's show was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, for past shows and special offers. And until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success.